Hello and welcome to Spotlights. This is the podcast for the Yale Forum on Religion and Ecology. And as usual, I'm your host, Sam Mickey. And this week, I'm really happy to welcome onto the show, Pankaj Jain. Pankaj, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Sam, for having me. And it was great. It's great to be back in touch with you.
Yeah, it's been a little while. You know, we both have some roots in the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas. And where you were teaching, I was a student there. And now you're at Flame University in India. You're the head of the Department of Humanities and Languages and chair of the India Center. So really cool work there. And you're an internationally recognized academic leader in so many areas, you know, sustainability, Jain studies, film studies, diaspora studies. So a really great example of the kind of interdisciplinary work that the Forum on Religion and Ecology is really all about. So for people who don't know, you have a few books out that, you know, over, I don't know, maybe the last 10 years, you've had a few books come out that are really important contributions to the fields that you're working with. Dharma and Ecology of Hindu Communities, Sustenance and Sustainability from back in 2011. Science and Socio-Religious Revolution in India, Moving the Mountains from 2016. And then most recently, Dharma in America, A Short History of Hindu Jain Diaspora. So I'm looking forward to hearing about those. But first, I just want to ask a little about you. How did you come to work with religion? Without, you know, you don't have to give your whole life story. But there's so many different paths that people can take. In academia, there's lots of fields to work with aside from religion. And if you want to engage with religion, there's a lot of ways to do it aside from academia. So how did you kind of come to this work?
Yeah, I think... as I came to the U.S. In late 90s as a software professional, sorry, I'm going into my biography, but I'll be really brief. I just started taking my heritage seriously. So I thought the best way to connect my passion and heritage with, you know, being in the U.S. is to go back to my heritage in an academic way and try to change a career and get a career in religious studies. And U.S., in the U.S., it's all possible. So I went for PhD and so on, and thankfully got a tenure track position also at UNT in Dallas area. And that's how it all happened over the years. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, right. Heritage is a big part of it. Like that happens for all of us at some point in our life. You have to think, how am I going to align myself with my heritage? Pick it up, not pick it up, engage with it academically
and how whatnot. And how to keep it relevant. So, you know, one way could have been for me to go back to some Sanskrit manuscripts and translate and, you know, get into literary studies, but I wanted to keep it contemporary relevant. So I chose environmental studies as the area because that's where I think heritage and culture and nature, they all, I think, make connections. And more, I think from the past, we need to learn to avoid future mistakes also, I think. Yeah. So that's how it all worked out.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, it's the weird thing about environmental studies, it just gets more and more relevant as our situation continues to deepen in its severity and intensity. So I would think, you know, more and more people are going to see whatever they're doing, some intersection with environmental work will help keep it more relevant. And so, you know, this brings us to your book, Dharma and Ecology of Hindu Communities, which is, you know, one of the landmark contributions to Hinduism and ecology that's out there. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about what's in this book. What was the, you know, overall intention of writing it? What are you trying to do? And what kind of stuff did you end up doing?
Yes. When I was taking a course, one of the PhD courses at Iowa was on environmental ethics, and there was very little academic material available back in 2004. I'm talking about very little material available on Hinduism and ecology, except some passing references. And there was, of course, the Harvard volume was out, but I mean, there was mostly from textual perspectives, not real world case studies of communities that actually have dealt with environmental issues for centuries. And then there was a passing reference to Bishnoi community that has sacrificed their own lives to save their flora and fauna in many, many instances. So being from that area myself, from Rajasthan, Western India, the desert area, the only state in India that has real desert, I also come from the same area where Bishnois are from. So I decided to choose that topic for my research. And then I added two more communities, Swadhyay and Bhil. So, and in the major, major way they differ from any environmental work or activism that happens in the West is that these communities are just living their life by following the principles or teachings laid out by their founders, gurus, they may or may not call themselves consciously environmentalists. They may not be reacting to climate change or loss of biodiversity. They're just trying to live according to the principles laid down by their founders. The dharmic tradition, dharmic teachings is their main focus. And any benefit to the environment is just a byproduct in their opinion, in their statement. So I consciously asked them questions that, are you doing this for environmental reasons? They were very humble and they said, no, we have nothing to do with the environment. We are just practicing with the environment. We are creating new sacred temples, sacred groves, as we know in from the literature. And anything is a, any benefit to the environment is just a byproduct. So it's, I think, a very different way of environmentalism. So that's why I think it falls into what we now call as dharmic ecology. So there is, of course, shallow ecology, deep ecology, as we all know from the literature. But dharmic ecology is a bit different from both because the main focus is dharma or the ethical teachings or, you know, maintaining the cosmic rhythm of the universe, the word rhythm that we get from the Rig Veda. So just by practicing that, just trying to align your activities with the activities of the earth, right? Trying to be in sync with nature by following these, by being vegetarians, by practice, by not cutting green trees, because trees are also to be revered. Trees are also alive and divine, and rivers are divine, and mountains, and stones, and reptiles, as you know, in Indian culture, Hinduism, and Jainism, and Buddhism. Every being is divine in all these traditions. So how do we connect that idea of divinity with environmentalism is what I observed when I traveled into these villages across Gujarat and Maharashtra and Madhya Pradesh and Rajasthan. And that is how, that is what I saw, that the founders and their teachers, gurus, made these connections, but without making them consciously environmentalist messages. It was all about, you know, being in tune with dharma. So I can go on, but I'll...
No, that's great. Because environmentalism is such like a Western construct, I mean, especially the United States. So even the idea of an environment, there's a similar thing with, you know, some Christians who are into creation, right? They'll talk about God's creation, but they're like, environment doesn't, nah, that's not like a motivating force for me. I wonder if you could say a little more about the difference between social ecology and deep ecology. Because, it does seem like dharmic ecology is somehow overcoming that dichotomy.
Yes, I think it does, because... again, it should not be reactionary is what they are saying. I think dharmic ecology people are saying that it should be part of our being, part of our DNA. Yeah. Being environmentalist is not a reaction to anything. It is just part of being who you are. Your nature, the all the five elements, all the natural elements are within you. As the Rig Veda says, that five great elements of earth and sun and moon and air and water are all within you also. You are intrinsically already a reflection, a part and parcel of nature around you, of the cosmos around you, Brahmand, or in the Sanskrit word is Brahmand, or Prithvi, the word for earth. So Gaia, I think Gaia hypothesis in Greek mythology, Greek, now we have in environmentalism, environmental literature also, this is pretty close to what I think what Hindus were saying when they were saying Prithvi is Mata, earth is mother, right? Or, and so on. So that should be part of our being every day when we wake up. When Hindus wake up across the world, millions of Hindus actually ask for forgiveness. That, oh, Mother Earth, I'm waking up. I'm going to walk on you, my mother. I'm touching you, my mother, with my feet. Please forgive me. This is the teaching. This is the practice of Hindus for millennia. For millions of Hindus, they still do it. More and more Hindus are, unfortunately, to our dismay, are getting so modernized that they're forgetting these teachings. But this is part of who Hindus were doing, what Hindus were doing, what Native Americans have been doing for millennia. For people in Japan, Shinto people in Japan, even Chinese people, indigenous. So indigenous people across the world have these teachings built into their culture, built into their mind, built into the DNA. But as they are all, we are all in, I'm in India, and in India is no stranger now to modernity and westernization, plasticization, McDonaldization, or Coke and Pepsi. So all those things are, we are losing here in India very sadly. But this is what has been happening for millennia for millions of people, indigenous people across the world. So environmentalism was, I don't think it was a reaction to any loss of biodiversity or climate change, but it was just who they were. That is what we need to bring back. And that is what my case studies were all about, are all about. Yes.
Yeah, and I appreciate also that one of the problems with a lot of the ways that the kind of American environmental movement frames itself is it's all this reacting to a crisis. And so that just inherently sets it up as bad news. And that hasn't been shown to motivate people. Some people have commented, you know, that Martin Luther King Jr. didn't say, "I have a nightmare." His famous speech was, I have a dream. You don't want to tell people, oh, things are really bad out there and we got to do something. And so it seems like Dharmic ecology is really focusing on just our connection to nature, celebrating that, revering it, respecting it, and not reacting against bad news, but really celebrating the good news, celebrating our connections.
Yeah, I think one more thing that I forgot to mention, if I can still mention it, I think shallow and deep ecology, the question that you had asked, and I didn't even touch upon that. Shallow and deep, I think, make the difference by saying that shallow is to utilitarianism, right? And deep is really keeping the nature, you know, untouched. So both are, I think, two extremes and not enough from the Dharmic ecology perspective, because deep is making these more, you know, greater barriers, keeping the national forests completely untouched by humanity. Now, that's impossible for a country like India, where all national parks that we have in India are all inhabited by humans and animals. Humans live with animals across India. So the only place outside Africa where you can find some lions is in India. Now, in those lion forests, humans are living as we speak for centuries and centuries and centuries. So you cannot just throw out humans outside those national parks or forests. That is the, I think, one of the major difference between deep ecology and Dharmic ecology. That humans are not evil by nature. Humans can live with nature. Sundarbans, another great example is Sundarbans in Bengal. So I took one example from Gir Forest from Gujarat, the east coast of India. Another example, if I can take, is from western coast of India, that is Bay of Bengal, where Sundarbans, the largest mangroves in the world, is completely inhabited, completely full of humans and man-eating tigers. Tigers are eating humans, but humans will rarely, if ever, go and hunt these tigers, because the belief is that there is Bon Bibi in the forest. Bon means forest in Bengali language. Bibi means Devi or goddess in Bengali language. So forest goddess is the protector of the forest. So hunting and poaching is still not done in that area of Sundarbans. You know, there is a great novel by Amitav Ghosh called Hungry Tide, one of the earliest climate fiction novels. And he does a great job of highlighting these, you know, uniqueness of Sundarbans. And then he came up with another recent book called Gun Island. And all these books are really showing how different people in places like Sundarbans and elsewhere, in indigenous people have been living with nature, and all is getting unfortunately disturbed by these forces of urbanization and so on. But still, as of now, India can still boast of one of the only countries that still has lions and rhinoceros, tigers, elephants, large number of elephants, tigers, and so on. All these wild beasts, large mammals. With 1.4 billion people, four times the population of USA, one-fourth the land mass of USA. So one-fourth natural resources compared to the US, but four times more population. So entire country, you know, entire population of US is almost 330 million people.
Right.
So, and that number is just dependent on one or two rivers in North India, Ganga and Yamuna, Ganges and Yamuna. Just those two rivers combined together serve the needs for 330 million people. Just staggering number. And how people do it left with all these animals around them. You know, if it were anywhere else, I think all these animals would have been gone, would have been killed, hunted, whatever. But this is a land where you still have so much of biodiversity, which is now greatly threatened. I don't mean to deny that, but so far things have still worked out. And hopefully, you know, we have to all try, keep trying that, you know, across the world, whatever we can save Amazonian forests or elsewhere, Indonesia and all, we have to keep trying to save them. These are the lungs of our planet, as you know.
I have Amitav Ghosh's new book, The Nutmeg's Curse, that's on my shelf to read.
I just finished it.
No, he's fantastic.
Yeah,
it's precisely that kind of idea of overcoming that old dichotomy between anthropocentrism and non-anthropocentrism.
Yeah.
I mean, like, no, you don't have to say no to the human in order to say yes to nature. Exactly. We can actually understand a deeper intimacy between them.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, you know, a big part of all this, you know, you're talking about the problems of modernization, right. Industrialization, urbanization. A big part of that is also modern science coming in.
Yes.
Right? You couldn't have had industrial technology without the modern scientific revolution supporting it. And so a big issue that always comes up kind of alongside religious environmentalism is the science-religion debate, science-religion dialogue, I guess you could say. So this is the topic of your book, Science and Socio-Religious Revolution in India, Moving the Mountains, which is a great subtitle. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, because kind of like talking about the environment, so kind of Western categories, and so likewise science and religion, so kind of Western categories that don't necessarily map onto South Asian contexts.
Right. So that's why I tried to first name the book actually Dharma and Science, not Religion and Science, but then you know, publishers demands. But yeah, I think Dharma. I think less and less these barriers and boundaries we find in non-Western cultures, including India and Africa and elsewhere. So, you know, many. So for my second book, I got the Fulbright Fellowship. I had received Fulbright Fellowship, and then I went to again to, you know, this time in Himalayas. So my first book was dealing with Western parts of India, Western central parts of India. For second book, I went up to the Himalayas in Uttarakhand, in a Himalayan state, where the Chipko movement had succeeded. It continues to succeed in saving thousands of native indigenous large trees across the Himalayas because of the efforts such as Chipko. Chipko literally means tree hugging. So that gave us the word tree hugger, right? Across the world now, people are tree huggers. Environmentalists are called as tree huggers because of the Chipko movement success in India. That Chipko literally means tree hugging. So in the legacy of, in the aftermath of Chipko happened in 1970s. So, and then one of the environmental leaders from that region of India, Dr. Anil Joshi, came to our ex-university, University of North Texas, Sam, where you were at one point of time and I was at one point of time. And when he came there, I was really impressed by what, being a botanist, he's a scientist, you know. And then he, at one point of time, he just resigned from his career, from his teaching career, and took his students and formed a new NGO called HESCO, Himalayan Environmental Studies and Conservation Organization, HESCO. And HESCO's efforts are in the legacy of Chipko only, but HESCO, being a scientist himself, he's trying to revive the indigenous scientific traditions of that region. So that is one of the regions, probably one of the many other regions, but certainly in India, probably the only region that had, for centuries, that had generated electrical energy kind of force by using the waterfalls in the Himalayas. So people who want wheat flour, being mostly vegetarian country that India is, people eat wheat chapatis or rotis or naans and dals or lentils. So they need wheat flour. How do you get wheat flour? So what they have been doing for centuries, in Himalayan women in the Himalayas also, again, what they've been doing is, you know, generating electrical kind of power by using water turbines, because Himalaya is the land of a lot of waterfalls. So they would install these turbines that would run from waterfalls, all these Himalayan waterfalls, that would generate energy, and that would help them in getting the flour from wheat. So all those things that they've been doing for centuries. So one of HESCO's efforts is to revive these indigenous traditions that have been lost during the British Raj or during the colonial periods. Many of these things were forgotten by the native people, indigenous people in Himalayas. So HESCO did this. They call it panchaki or water mill, let's just go with water mill. So water mills were really, thousands of water mills were revived, refurbished. And, you know, because of this revival, a lot of fossil fuel that would have reached Uttarakhand, also the Himalayan region also, because of these indigenous technologies, fossil fuel usage remained, I think, pretty low in many, many parts of the Himalayas. One thing that they did. Other thing that they did also, which is major part of my second book, all this research, is to revive the diverse farming across the Himalayan region. So, you know, with mono farming or monocultures of farming that we have in the US, either wheat or either corn or so on, in Indian farming or non-Western, I think most non-Western farming is diverse farming, where you have one lentil, second lentil, third lentil, wheat, and all those fruits and vegetables all grow together in one small piece of land instead of large industry farming. So, of course, factory farming, we all know, is bad, because a lot of violence is done to the animals and a lot of violence done to Amazonian forests because of factory farming and so on. But even vegetarian factory farming or industrial farming is extremely detrimental to the health of our planet and to us. So HESCO, what they have done is to revive these traditional farming ways of farming, where more diversity is involved as they farm all these crops. So that is also one of the efforts by HESCO. And many, many other such efforts that they've been doing by combining traditional ways of farming, traditional ways of generating electricity by combining dharmic, these cultural traditions with scientific traditions and so on. And then other case study that I took. So three case studies I took for my first book. For this book, I took two case studies. So my second case study was a Sikh guru in Punjab who has done wonderful things. He's still doing great things in Punjab. For example, single-handedly, he and his followers cleaned up a major river in Punjab. The holiest river for Sikh. Sikh is the fifth largest and youngest religion in the world. And started on the borders of India-Pakistan region in northwestern India-Pakistan. And the founder of that religion, Guru Nanak, attained his enlightenment ever in Punjab. And that very river was extremely polluted until this Sikh Baba Sichewal, he realized this and he just plunged into the river and started cleaning the river by his own hands. And looking at him, his followers also did the same thing. And so by their efforts, major river is cleaned and a lot of trees have been planted. And so that became my second case study. So that's a big, a short summary of my second book.
Yeah. I like in all these cases that it's so grounded in case studies, because it's easy to just get into kind of worldviews or metaphysical ideas. You see that sometimes when people are like, well, Advaita Vedanta says we're all one and therefore, yes. It's like, well, that doesn't necessarily translate
exactly
in actions exactly. The way it might sound like. I'm curious about the traditional farming practices. As you mentioned, like vegetarianism isn't so good right. If it's monoculture, and right. that kind of thing, that the fossil fuel inputs and all, just terrible. What's the role of animals in some of these traditional farming practices? Are people working with animals on the land? Are they consuming animals at all?
Oh, cattle is, you cannot imagine even vegetarian farming without cattle in India. Every farmer is just by default, when we mention farmers, we mention bulls and cows and cattle largely. And those cattle are never killed by most farmers. Farmers, when they are growing any crops, are never killing any cattle. The only livestock that is killed by butchers for meat consumption, so India is not 100% vegetarian, of course, as we know. So only livestock that is actually killed in most parts of India, if ever, would be chicken. And of course, for mutton, that is goat and sheep, right? Or that would be the most part. Beef is almost never, even McDonald's in India cannot or do not sell beef. Beef patties are just out of question, right? Yeah. So most cattle would never be killed in India, and we know from scientific research now that biggest, most threatening meat in the world for our health and for planet's health is beef. Mm-hmm. Cow meat causes the most consumption of fossil fuel as the food is grown to feed to these cattle, and as those cattle are grown up and when they are butchered. That meat is again transported across America or across the world, again causing a lot of consumption of huge amounts of fossil fuels. So beef is the number one culprit when it comes to even non-vegetarian food, even meat consumption of all kinds. Beef is the worst food to consume for our health. Of course, red meat, as we know, is extremely injurious to our health. And red meat is also extremely injurious to planet's health. So thankfully, Indian consumption of red meat is one of the lowest in the world. Indian consumption of per capita usage of personal car is also one of the lowest. These two, biggest reasons for carbon footprint across the world, personal cars, automobiles, and beef, remains significantly low per capita, at least in India. So that is why when it comes to COP26 kind of situations, Indian argument is always this, that per capita consumption, we have the lowest. And we have significant number of people who are still under poverty line. We have to still, empower them and raise their economic standards. So do not impose your standards on us. First, clean up your house. That has been the political argument by Indian leaders, which can be justified at some extent, to some extent. But personally, I would, like to urge my Indian political leaders also to wake up before it's too late and, avoid all the floods. Every Indian city is now getting flooded every year. Mumbai is under deluge, Chennai and Kolkata, entire state of Kerala, India is no stranger to all these climate disasters. So we are, hopefully the people will, wake up sooner than later and say what is left in India and across the world.
Yeah, that's such a tough point. The United States wants to point fingers at India and say, well, your emissions. Yeah. And then he's like, no, yours. And it's like, well, we all have issues we need to work with in our own ways. Right. Speaking of the fact that we both have experience with Texas, that's a really good example of how America loves beef and cars. Those are just very, very predominant there. You can't get around without a car, and you can't really have a meal without beef. People kind of look at you funny in some contexts. I like that a lot. I wonder also, you know, speaking of the water wheels.
Oh, yeah, sure.
How many people in India don't have access to electricity even?
Oh, that's only recently, actually, when Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power, when he became Prime Minister for the first time, in his first term, he and his government boasted or announced that first time entire India is now electrified, at least from their number. Huh. So only recently, entire country has been electrified. Almost entire country now also has access to clean sanitation needs also. So they built thousands and thousands of toilets across India also. So very recently, unfortunately, it took a really long time for even to get basic needs. It has taken seven decades for Indians to get all those basic needs.
Wow. Wow. So interesting to think that's all happening, you know, with the Green Revolution is happening and all these things. And yet some progress was just so slow.
Yeah.
And then the neoliberalization of markets happened very quickly. And then getting people basic needs very slowly in comparison.
Exactly.
Well, so then for, you know, Hindu, Jain contexts, science versus religion just doesn't make sense. It's not, those aren't two separate categories because it's just different traditional knowledges.
Yeah, I think, right. I think we can say that because see, even from scientific, only recently we have discovered, right, from United Nations reports and many scientific reports are now saying that red meat is bad for our health. Red meat is bad for planet's health. But Hindus and Jains stopped eating red meat from millennia, right after the Buddha and Mahavira came 2500 years from now. They already, before that, apparently there was animal sacrifice was happening in Hindu rituals. But over centuries, as Buddha and Mahavira, they emphasized this non-violence, Jainism and Buddhism. Red meat suddenly disappeared, not suddenly probably, but over the centuries probably, red meat just vanished from Indian consumption, Indian rituals and consumption and so on. It all tiered down or petered down to maybe chicken consumption or maybe goat consumption. And thousands of people, probably millions of people have become completely vegetarian, including myself, over millennia. Jains are all Jains across the world now have been always vegetarians. Not vegans. I know even dairy is a problem now. So the next step has to be by Jains and Hindus to stop even dairy, because that is also, you know, almost equally disastrous to our planet's health. But as long as that would be next frontier for vegetarians. That remains to be achieved.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's hard to eliminate 100% animal products and byproducts. It's a little extra work. And yes. I wonder what would happen to, you know, the cattle that are part of the farming practices. Would they be there, you're just not using them for dairy, but they would still graze and fertilize the land? And because I think they're such good fertilizing machines and compared to using like chemical fertilizers and that sort of thing.
Exactly. So cow dung is used, or, you know, waste product from cattle is used for organic fertilizers, but also bulls are used for actual plowing the land.
Right.
So not all Indian farmers have tractors. So a bull or a pair of bull would actually pull the plow to till the land. So that is the integral part of, that's why I said that, you know, you cannot imagine farming without bulls and cattle in India. Right. And then let's say if the cattle become sick or old and they're no longer productive for farming, right? What happens to those cattle? Those cattle are sent to thousands and thousands of these cattle sanctuaries across India, where Hindus and Jains have donated thousands and thousands, probably millions of rupees now, where all these sick and old cattle are preserved forever. And in some examples, they would even play nonstop Hindu or Jain chants as if to share the spiritual messages of the Vedas or Jain texts, even within among the animals, among cattle certainly, but even even other animals are included in this site. So there is a temple, there is a hospital in Delhi, heart of Delhi, old Delhi. There is a bird hospital where any bird that is hurt because of ceiling fan and so on would be treated there, and that hospital is donated by Hindus and Jains. So such hospitals and such cattle sanctuaries are spread across India, where even a sick or old cattle is taken care of, with all the care that people can share.
So that's pretty good.
Features.
Yeah. No, I like that a lot. I know plenty of animal lovers would be like, I think animal hospitals and sanctuaries should be playing some music. we need some spiritual music, some chanting, something to connect. The animals would want it. I'm sure they must enjoy it.
Right.
Yes, oh, geez. Yes. That's really great. Well, I wonder, the subtitle, I love the subtitle, Moving the Mountains.
Right.
What is that referring to?
Not literally, of course, but because Himalayas are already moving. They're one of the youngest mountains in the world. So they're always moving. There are a lot of these flash floods and so on. It's been very risky, actually, to live in the Himalaya. I remember I was with Professor George James, your professor and my colleague, and when we were there in 2013, when we were there in Dehradun with one of the earliest and legendary late environmentalist, Sundarlal Bahuguna, one of the leaders of Chipko movement, and we were at his cottage, my family and Professor George James, and that time there was this massive flood suddenly happened, and literally water came to our feet, and we had to all evacuate HESCO's office. We were at all this HESCO's compound, and we were sitting with Sundarlal Bahuguna, and we all had to evacuate immediately. So Himalayas is already, always on the move. All I'm saying is this, right? And so moving the mountain here is just figuratively, that to work on environmental issues is kind of sort of figuratively moving the mountains, because it's sort of going against the onslaught of, like you said, scientism or right technologies and all these urbanization, fossil fuels and whatnot, to go against that conventional wisdom now, which has become conventional wisdom, is kind of figuratively moving the mountain. But so far, thankfully, they have been succeeding, although not to the extent that we would all like, but at least they're trying. They're trying to move the mountain.
Yeah,
as we speak.
Yeah, right. There's so many efforts that kind of feel like that. Like, hey, it's working. Not as much as we'd want or as quick as we'd want, and yet, but it is working. So, there's a little, So it's not perfect, but you see signs of things getting better, and that's so heartening. Any little glimmers of hope, I'll take them wherever they might be.
Yes.
Lisa, I want to talk about your more recent book, Dharma in America, A Short History of Hindu Jain Diaspora. That's something I'm very curious about, and because if I ever teach kind of world religions kind of stuff and talking about Hinduism and Jainism, I don't have a lot of knowledge of what the diaspora looks like in America. I know a handful of communities here and there, but I don't know the whole story. So I think it's a really interesting one. So I'm wondering, what were your overall findings, or what brought you to want to study that in the first place?
Not too far from where you are, Sam, in Los Angeles, there is a university, as you know, Loyola Marymount University, where our respected Professor Chris Chappell is also there. But also there is Professor Amir Hussain there, who wrote a recent book called Muslims and the Making of America. And he starts the book with this line that you cannot imagine creation or existence or flourishing of the United States from the earliest days without Muslims. Because Muslims were part of all the thousands of slaves that were brought from Africa to Americas. So from the early days on, Muslims have been part of the fabric of America. That was really interesting insight for me, at least. So then I started wondering if we can imagine similar things about Hindus or Jains also. And then I thought that if I can extend the boundary of America from United States to maybe include North America and South America, then I can probably we can also make a similar argument, that similar case, that certainly for Suriname, Central American and South American countries such as Suriname in South America, and Trinidad in Central America, and Guyana and Jamaica, they had seen arrival of Hindus from the days of British Raj, that is almost 150 years from now, when Hindus had started coming to these parts of the world, these parts of parts of Central America. So, you know, long after Columbus started calling them Indians, because by he was mistaken that, you know, it's part of India, right? As he was looking for a sea route to India, and he ended up in somewhere in Bahamas, right? Somewhere in Caribbean islands. So those islands that were already called, you know, people they were living there are already called as Indians, but actually Indians arrived with the British Raj when they brought all these people to work on their farms. So that's the start of the story of arrival of Indians or Hindus in Americas. Then I started looking for ways how they have made their contribution. So Professor Hussain makes the case that in sports and in films and in politics, what all Muslims have done as their contribution to making of America. And then when I looked for similar examples, I thought that maybe I can make the case in terms of classical music, when Ravi Shankar and Zakir Hussain and Allah Rakha enthralled the mainstream of American music lovers with their sitar and with their flute and with their tabla in the 70s and 80s. Right. And then and many, many such examples, also similar examples, I think probably we can draw from Ayurveda and yoga as they caught the attention of mainstream Americans. Certainly yoga did, but Ayurveda also is now increasingly people are turning towards alternative medicine, right, which is more based on herbal medicine than, you know, alternative therapies without injecting too much chemicals into our bodies. If we can treat our body and keep ourselves healthy based on herbal intake, based on natural elements, that is what Ayurveda is all about. So I did one chapter on Ayurveda. And Indian doctors in general also, what all Indian doctors coming from India have done for the mainstream, even, you know, mainstream biomedical traditions also in America. So that became one chapter. Then one chapter became what all, how they're contributing to civic, local civic institutions such as city council or school board elections, what all people are doing. So that became one chapter. And so all those little contribution that Indians have been also making or Hindus have been also making. And then one chapter covers the entire history of Jainism in America, how Jains came in 1890s. The first Jain to come to America was in 1893 with Swami Vivekananda, first Hindu to come to America. Oh. And then I traced the entire history of Jains also in one of the chapters of that book. So diverse chapters, but, you know, different ways that, you know, we can say that probably they have also tried to make their contribution.
That's great. Yeah, so many different lines of historical connection. Yeah, I just love stories like that because I, you know, we get this very kind of homogenized sense of like what American history is. And if you just look a little different angle, it turns out, no, there's so many more complex influences and events happening. And yeah, no, I like that a lot. Yeah, I didn't even think of course, sitar and tabla in the 70s. Yeah, that was just huge. And still in so much, yeah, so much music, dance music, electronic music. You'll always hear like a tabla in the background. And it's completely changed the face of music worldwide. That's great. Good. These are good stories. Well, you know, that was published in 2019, right? Dharma in America. So, you know, the ancient past. So I'm curious, what are you working on lately? No pressure to have a new project. You've already done so much work.
So many projects. So one is I'm co-editing with Professor Jeffrey Long and Professor Rita Sharma and others, and Professor Arvind Sharma and all. We are co-editing the Encyclopedia of Hinduism, Indian Religions, including Jainism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sikhism, and so on, for Springer. That's almost done. Just finishing the print edition now. And another is a volume on the philosophical theories to study religions across the world that I'm also editing with Jeffrey Long. Then I'm working on some articles on climate change and COVID scenarios. Then and so many, you know, like things like that. And of course, giving webinars and so on. But yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Don't forget about the webinars, especially the last couple of years. Everybody's on Zoom now for everything. So many webinars and podcasts. And yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot to keep track of. No, that sounds really good. I wonder if you could say a little about what your thoughts are on climate change and COVID-19. You know, I got my booster shot for my vaccine today.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, I was a little worried it might be like down and or something, but no symptoms so far. Sore in the shoulder. But aside from that, yeah, I'm okay.
Wow. You're strong, man.
Apparently, yeah. The actual vaccine hit me harder. The booster wasn't too bad, so I can't complain. But yeah, so I'm wondering if there's a few of the connections that you've noticed?
Sam, I think there are all kinds of connections to be made between climate change, that is ecology, COVID, that is pandemic, and economy. They're all interconnected. I think we cannot remain in silos. They're all interconnected. They're because of our craze, or what Amitabh Ghosh calls it, the deranged mind we are all living in. The more we keep ignoring climate change issues, disasters that are happening every day in the US, we hear news, rare tornadoes that never happened in December, rare floods or rare wildfires that never happened in this part of the month or that part of America. Every day we hear these news and we still continue to ignore them. COVID comes as a big slap on our humanity's face, that now is the time to wake up and stop killing more forests, because as you destroy forests, all those viruses have to invade on humans. They become invasive species, literally, because they lose their own native lands. That is why we get COVID like scenarios. So it is, of course, it is time to wake up and really, really change our behaviors, really tighten our belts, reduce or stop our meat consumptions, reduce or stop our fossil fuel consumption. Biggest reason is fossil fuel addiction, right? And yet we don't even talk about the defense establishment, the Pentagon. Biggest polluter, biggest emitter of carbon is Pentagon. We can't even include that even in COP26 in Glasgow. Not a single mention of defense establishment, not just by US, of course, but even by India or China or all across the country. But of course, US is the biggest consumer of these defense equipment and so on, and seller of the defense equipment across the world. Right. So we have to, I don't know what we can do. Nobody would listen to us if we talk to anybody in Pentagon or in White House. They will keep doing these things in the name of national defense. But we can at least, these are the things we have to wake up and stop. Else we are all going to be gone, in no time.
I appreciate the point about defense and the Pentagon. Yeah, I've seen the kind of chart of how much the United States spends on defense measured up with every other country on the planet, and the U.S. spends a little more than everybody else combined. That's just so unfathomable. And then to think of the fossil fuel use that's going into that, it's just maddening. And yet such a site for opportunity, because we probably don't need quite so much defense. And so this would be an area where we could have rapid transitions and take all these people and all their resources and their intelligence and kind of move them toward renewable energy, regenerative agriculture. And so there's hope. But I do appreciate, the COVID described as a slap in the face to humanity. Like, hey, wake up. So that's the best possible
Mother Earth is slapping us. Mother Earth.
Yeah, right, exactly. A little slap
like a good
for
mother.
Mom. Yeah.
Like a good mother.
Sometimes mom needs to wake you up.
Yes.
Well, geez. I could chat with you for so long about this. You have so many good stories.
It's great to connect with somebody who already knows all these issues. Otherwise, I don't have to, right? It's like same frequency we are all on. We both are on. So
yeah, for sure.
Really great to chat. Yes.
Yeah, and reading some of the same books and thinking along the same issues. Yeah, really a pleasure. Well, geez, I'll have to have you back next time. You have some stuff coming out. Come back on. We'll chat about it and let the world know. It's great work. And it's just like hearing stories where you're hanging out with like Sundarlal Bahugada and there's a flood. So some of this just reads like a novel.
it's all personal experience also.
Yep. So you got to be keeping track of those. You got to, expect to see some memoirs coming out at some point.
Sure, would love to. Would love to, yes.
All right, awesome. Well, geez, Pankaj Jain. Thanks for being here. Really
thank you, Sam.
It.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for all the great work. Keep doing all these things that you're doing, Sam. Wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah. And thanks to everybody for tuning in. So we'll be back next week with some more conversations for you. So in the meantime, take care and be well.